Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Mattia Kramer, a senior research analyst at the National Priorities Project, a non-profit, non-partisan research organization dedicated to making complex federal budget information transparent and accessible. We will discuss the lack of transparency behind the recent much-heralded fiscal cliff deal, the contents of which are only now coming to light. Then we'll discuss how the big lie lost with William Grider, the national affairs correspondent with The Nation, where he has an article, "The Big Lie Loses." With the phony fiscal cliff drama now over, before the next one begins over the debt ceiling, we will examine whether the Wall Street titans responsible for our collapsed economy will be able to continue punishing the wrong people for the nation's economic ills by demonizing popular federal programs like Social Security, which they blame for the deficits, instead of their own reckless greed. Then finally, best-selling author Jared Diamond joins us to discuss his latest book, The World Until Yesterday, What Can We Learn from Traditional Societies? The author of Collapse and Guns, Germs and Steel, and a professor of geography at UCLA, he spent decades with tribes in the remote New Guinea highlands, and he brings the wisdom of the natural world back to our troubled, civilized lives, beset by obesity from corporate food, paranoia from mindless media, and planetary destruction from compulsive consumption. And joining us now is Mattia Kramer, who's a senior research analyst at the National Priorities Project, a national nonprofit, nonpartisan research organization dedicated to making complex federal budget information transparent and accessible. They recently released a book, A People's Guide to the Federal Budget. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mattia Kramer.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So, Mattia, the idea that you're trying to make the federal budget transparent and accessible, this deal that was just struck, nobody knew the details of it until after it was done. There was no transparency, and everybody's sort of celebrating this kind of, you know, avoiding something worse. But I think people are not focusing on that, you know, whatever the deal is, this is no way to run a railroad.
That's right. We're so distracted by the fact that there was this looming crisis that we haven't had a moment to stop and say, our democratic process broke down. This is not how our government ought to be run. We saw elected officials, just the very top leadership, craft a deal that will affect this country for years to come, with little or no input, certainly from the American people, but hardly from most of our representatives in Congress.
And then we find out that there's a bunch of pork in there as well that somehow got slipped in for NASCAR, for film and television production. So how did that happen?
Well, those kinds of add-ons are often part of legislation, and they're more and more coming to light, which, you know, I think is a good thing. You know, what's funny about those kinds of earmarks, they're often called, is that those have often been used to grease the wheels of the democratic process. So we have a political system in this country that makes it difficult to accomplish things. You know, we have a system in which we have all these representatives all acting with different motives and self-interest, and those earmarks can sometimes grease the wheels and help craft a deal. And so it's absolutely important that light be shone on them, and in many cases they represent hardly the interests of the people at large, but they have in many cases served a purpose.
So what about this deal strikes you as you're concerned mostly about the process, right? That it wasn't transparent. And now, of course, it's your job to make sense of it. So what can you do to help us on both?
Sure. Well, one surprising and important thing that came out of the deal was the extension of unemployment benefits. So federal emergency unemployment benefits were scheduled to expire at the end of 2012. About 2 million Americans would have lost benefits, and then folks who would have been eligible for that program in 2013 would not have been because of the expiration of these emergency benefits. And so that by no means was guaranteed if a deal did come to pass. And so the passage of that extension is a very good thing for some of our most vulnerable citizens.
Well, but the payroll tax holiday is over, right? Everybody's going to feel the pinch in their checks, their monthly or biweekly paychecks.
That's right. And that's not as much of a surprise. So lawmakers in general had not pushed for the extension of the payroll tax holiday. I think some Democratic lawmakers wanted to see that tax holiday extended, and they had long seen that it wasn't likely to be included, and they'd sort of given up that fight. And so, indeed, this tax holiday expires. What it means is the rate at which workers pay into the Social Security program will return to 6.2% of wages. It was temporarily reduced to 4.2%, but that was just for 2 years. That was passed back in 2010. And now it will return to its normal rate of 6.2%. And that's actually, from the perspective of the Social Security program, that's a good thing. It's certainly not a good thing from the perspective of Americans having money in their pockets, and it will, as you're saying, it will have a negative effect on the economy.
Again, I'm speaking with Mattia Kramer, who's a senior research analyst at the National Priorities Project, a national nonprofit, nonpartisan research organization dedicated to making complex federal budget information transparent and accessible. They recently released a book, A People's Guide to the Federal Budget. Now, another thing that was slipped in, well, I don't know whether these things are slipped in at the dead of night and how they get in and why it is we never hear about them until it's a fait accompli, but for example, the fact that the White House and the Democrats appeared to cave on tax on dividends and on carried interest. We know from the last election that Mitt Romney and people like him make their money off dividends and they only pay 15% tax if they pay any tax at all because they can carry the interest indefinitely, it seems. There was an expectation that what was on the table was, had they not made a deal, it would have gone back to 39.6% tax, and instead they settled for 20% tax above 15, which is not really a great deal of pain. My sense is if that had that been out in the open, enough Americans would have weighed in and said, no, you know, we've had enough of these people getting a free ride, the richest in this country. This whole idea that we're taxing the rich again or they're going back to the Clinton rates misses the point. Most of the rich make their money this way through capital gains.
Well, and Ian, another point about that is that that rate rises to 20% only for income above that $400,000 or $450,000 threshold, right? It's $400,000 for individuals, $450,000 for couples. So the rate only rises for income above that very high threshold. And you know, keep in mind, average Americans are earning, you know, $50,000 a year or so forth. So this is an extremely high threshold, roughly corresponding with the wealthiest 1% of Americans.
So no way in the world that we can consider this a victory for tax fairness. And it's not doing a lot for the Treasury in terms of revenues.
Well, so it will raise some new revenues. It's certainly not what Democrats had hoped for, and it's important to keep in mind in this discussion, federal tax revenue as a share of the U.S. economy right now is at its lowest point in about 60 years. So, you know, because of tax cuts, tax loopholes, we are paying less in taxes, even if it doesn't feel like that. And so this deal included some new revenues. That's an important stride. But as you're saying, of course, it's hardly problem solved.
So the ghost of George W. Bush still haunts Washington. I mean, he ran up these vast deficits and ended up at the end of his second term, the economy crashed. And a lot of people on the right think it's a good thing that the government shrinks and essentially becomes powerless and penniless. But at the end of the day, this deal has really not undone what Bush did in terms of tax cuts. It's done it for people under households earning under $450,000. But, I mean, they've retained their tax breaks, but the people above haven't. So it's still perpetuating this kind of dogma against taxes, which come down to the heart of how a government functions. And the really adult conversation this country surely needs, based upon what you just told us, that we're paying record low taxes for the last 60 years, if these people are going to complain about this deficit, as they do all the time, and the Pete Petersons of this world keep beating this drum, then how the hell can, why are we listening to them? I mean, everybody's got to say, okay, if this is as serious as you say it is, then we all have to pitch in.
Yeah, the point about why are we all focused on this notion of deficits, you know, that has a lot to do with how much attention it's gotten in the media. You know, many folks would say that the top priority should be economic recovery and then deficit reduction in the long term. But deficit reduction and the magnitude of the federal debt have gotten so much attention in the media that we're all sort of trained to think at this point that deficit reduction ought to happen. Now, as a corollary of that, we've also been hearing that it should happen solely through spending cuts. But when we hear this fact that federal tax revenue is at a historic low right now, that certainly brings into light that we ought to be looking at both sides of the budget, right? The federal budget is two things, it's spending and it's revenue.
Well, the Republicans are now saying, now we're going to start focusing on spending. And, you know, a lot of Democrats are celebrating, and so is the White House, that they managed to basically get, you know, the tax side of it done, but not the revenue side of it done. And, you know, they came out unscathed in terms of not cutting any programs. And now the Republicans are sharpening their knives and saying, now it's time to start cutting programs. And but this is, again, is a phony debate, because nobody's talking about the biggest items that are driving the deficit, and that is out-of-control healthcare costs and out-of-control military spending. Both of those seem to be pretty much off the table. So all you've got left is discretionary spending, and they're going to pare that down to the Eisenhower era. So, you know, we'll basically have a government that's a war machine and a pension plan.
Well, and non-military discretionary spending is such a small share of the total budget that even if you eliminated it completely, it would scarcely solve our budget problems, and then you'd have, you know, no programs in education, no programs in roads and infrastructure. So that's, of course, a preposterous notion. So lawmakers will have to look to controlling health care costs, as you're saying, and likely defense costs as well.
Well, you're saying they'll have to, but will they?
Well, we're expecting a debate over what's being called entitlement reform in the coming year, and some proposals were put forth during the fiscal cliff negotiations. Raising the Medicare eligibility age was one of them. We're likely to see these proposals and others surface in 2013, and so there will be discussion about reducing healthcare spending. The question is, will it be benefit cuts, or will it be fundamental change in the way that we pay for healthcare in order to preserve benefits for entitled Americans, you know, folks who are retired and rely on these programs, and will we do so by driving down the cost of health care rather than simply cutting benefits?
Well, I thank you for joining us, Mattia Kramer, and for making complex federal budget information transparent and accessible. I'd say in closing, you've got your work cut out.
Indeed we do. I hope folks will visit our website. It's nationalpriorities.org. There's a lot more information there, and a book out called A People's Guide to the Federal Budget, and I hope folks will check it out.
Well, I thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Mattia Kramer, who's a senior research analyst at the National Priorities Project, a national nonprofit, nonpartisan research organization dedicated to making complex federal budget information transparent and accessible. And as she just said, they recently released a book, A People's Guide to the Federal Budget. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back talking with Bill Greider about how the big lie lost. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is William Greider, who is the National Affairs Correspondent for The Nation and the author of the bestsellers One World Ready or Not, Secrets of the Temple, and Who Will Tell the People. A reporter for 40 years, he has written for The Washington Post and Rolling Stone and has been an on-air correspondent for 6 frontline documentaries on PBS. His latest book is The Soul of Capitalism, Opening Paths to a Moral Economy. And his latest article at The Nation is The Big Lie Loses. And we're waiting now to get Bill Greider on the phone. Apparently he's not with us right yet. Can you keep calling him? Because we do have an appointment to talk to him now. And I spoke to him shortly before he went on the air. Again, we're hoping to get through to William Greider, the National Affairs Correspondent for The Nation, and author of the bestsellers One World, Ready or Not, Secrets of the Temple, and Who Will Tell the People. His latest article at The Nation is The Big Lie Loses, and of course, The Big Lie is the, according to William Grider, is the idea that somehow the people who caused the crash in 2008, the ones that really tanked the economy, have managed to convince most Americans that somehow they are responsible for the collapsed economy, and that the Social Security and these other popular federal programs are to blame for the deficits instead of the reckless behavior of those on Wall Street who brought about the collapse of the economy. And of course, George W. Bush, who presided over the collapse of the economy in 2008, is also running up a couple of wars he didn't pay for that contributed to it as well. William Grider, thanks for joining us. And we're discussing your article at The Nation, The Big Lie Loses. I was sort of giving a vamping a bit there, describing the big lie. So why don't you describe the big lie?
Well, I'm fighting off my dog, so.
is that what happened? So
they want to be in on this interview, I'm afraid.
Okay.
Okay, I'm getting him locked in another room. The big lie that has been popularized, I mean, I don't know if I've ever seen anything quite like it, except maybe during World War II, where the whole country was taught to believe certain things. And it was so powerful that almost no one would challenge it, except a few of us flakes on the left, I guess. But the lie was this, led by Pete Peterson and other financial billionaires. They told the country through the big media that Social Security and entitlements in general, Medicare, etc., were responsible for our debt and deficits. And that's a lie. They were shifting the blame from our economic predicament to the wrong people, in fact, to people who were victims. And I could go into great detail explaining why this was the case, but essentially, if you read the newspapers, you heard again and again that Social Security and entitlements caused the debt and the deficits. I heard it again tonight on PBS in an interview. There was standard talk of the major media. People at large who actually pay the money into Social Security every payday and their deductions from their paycheck know that this is a lie. Not all of them, of course, but most people, working people, understand that that money is taken out of their paycheck and put into a Social Security trust fund, which will eventually cover their retirement benefits. That's the way the system has worked, has always worked since the 1930s. And the Social Security does not borrow from the rest of us, the Treasury or the federal government. The opposite occurs. The federal government borrows from Social Security. At this point, it has now owed Social Security Trust Fund something like $2.7 trillion. Now, people like myself have written this again and again, or literally, in my case, over 20, 25 years. But the power of mass media, when it wants to tell the same lie over and over again, is overwhelming. The miracle of this moment, in my view, is that the people never bought the lie. Obviously, a lot of elites did, in the media, in government, in politics, etc., including both political parties. But if you go to anybody can do this, go to Google and look up all the polling on Social Security, and you will see that it's still overwhelmingly not just endorsed, but defended by the broad public. And it doesn't split much along ideological lines, because people, whether they're conservatives or liberals, understand what it's about. So I'll stop talking, but you can tell I have some passion on this subject.
Sure. Well, I've
been arguing it for literally since the 1980s when they did the bait and switch with Social Security recipients. And I told myself then, I was then a reporter and editor in Washington Post, I didn't stand up effectively at that moment, but by God, when they came back to get this money, I was gonna stay with the issue, and I have.
Well, William Grider, I feel equally passionate about the insult and injury that these Wall Street titans, who are responsible for our collapsed economy, and the idea that they can they've come up with this way of punishing the wrong people, as you say, from the nation's economic ills by demonizing Social Security, which they've been trying to blame for the deficits instead of their own reckless greed. And Pete Peterson, who you mentioned, he's been spending money, which, of course, to him is nothing. He's worth $10, $15 billion. He's been buying all of these academic whores and media pundits in New York and Washington. He even underwrote some of the Simpsons-Bowles Commission. He's got Maya McGuinness on the payroll. He's got the Concord Coalition. He has... Every time any think tank in Washington has a seminar on the economy, he's there, obviously underwriting it all. I mean, it's amazing to think that the chutzpah of these people is breathtaking.
But Ian, you have just described why I am feeling exhilarated by these events, because I've followed this literally over several decades, and I saw the people putting in place this concoction, this fiction that somehow the old geezers are robbing from the young and are draining the vital fluids of our society by their outrageous entitlements, etc., etc. And I thought, well, this surely can't sell. And then I watched as the big media, important pundits, with a few noble exceptions, who bought into this lie and repeat it endlessly. They're repeating it again this week and lamenting the fact that Congress and the President failed to do anything about Social Security, which we all know is the source of our problem, blah, blah, blah. So you see, what I'm recognizing is that the lie lost.
Well, you know, just to give the audience an idea of the lie and how pervasive it is and how often it's been put out there, in one of the presidential debates, perhaps it was the vice presidential debate, Martha Raddatz of ABC News, who's a part of the press establishment, prefaced a question by saying, you all know that Social Security is going broke. Which is not.
Wrong, right.
So, I mean, it's...
You know, my guess is, I don't want to pick on individual reporters. She's not any dumber than any others, and she's probably pretty smart.
Yeah.
But she's never done the reporting.
Right.
I mean that literally, and she's not alone. David Brooks has never done the reporting. I can say that with great confidence, because if he'd done the reporting, he wouldn't have the nerve to write those things, because he would know they are mendacious. So I'm feeling like it needs to be said, and I will say it again and again, I'm sure, that the big money, notwithstanding the fact that it dominates the mass media and it controls the message and finances the politicians and it does this and does that, blah, 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 it also can lose when it's trying to sell something to ordinary people that the ordinary folks know is a lie.
Well, you could argue that's what happened in the last election in terms of the plutocrat from Wall Street that they were trying to sell. Again, I'm speaking with William Grider, the national affairs correspondent for The Nation and the author of the bestsellers One World, Ready or Not, Secrets of the Temple and Who Will Tell the People. He's been a reporter for 40 years and has written for The Washington Post and Rolling Stone and has been an on-air correspondent for 6 frontline documentaries on PBS. And his latest book is The Soul of Capitalism, Opening Paths to to a moral economy. And his latest article at The Nation is The Big Lie Loses. Just to touch on the stories of today, William Grider, as the least productive Congress since the 1940s, the 112th goes off into the sunset and the 113th begins today. The Speaker, John Boehner, has been sort of soundly beaten up in the last couple of days. He survived the vote and the long knives of Cantor. It looks to me like Cantor could have won that, but he doesn't want that job. It's better to have this guy,
That's the hangman's job.
Exactly.
Well, but Ian, let me make another point off of what I've been ranting about. I have also a somewhat eccentric understanding of what's happening now in politics, which is optimistic, because I view what we have seen in the last few months, starting with the great election outcome, of what I think is going to prove to be a profound shift in our politics. And by that I mean the conservative era that we have lived with for 30 years, starting with Ronald Reagan and Milton Friedman and all that good stuff, is over. That's not recognized yet, unfortunately, by most politicians, but that's what events are telling me. And some of my friends and critics on the left, who I share their criticisms of Obama, etc., but I think what they're missing is that the deep ideological cast of politics in this country is like a big ocean liner. It slows down, and then it starts a turn which doesn't happen in one event or 10 events or 50 events. It is like a long, sweeping turn, and that's what we've entered into, and that's what makes me optimistic. So, and I am willing, for the moment at least, to judge President Obama more sympathetically than I usually have, because I think he's now been put in a position, partly by his own design, I hope, to be able to shift the focus of his own politics in his second term. I can't guarantee that that's going to happen. I may be disappointed. But right now, I'm seeing the ingredients of a new politics. Let me give you one brief example of what I mean by that. The press coverage is still obsessed with the fact that those nasty Republicans have set up another cliff and another cliff after that and another cliff after that. And based on their own experience with this, they are soon again writing gloom and doom stories about, well, yes, we got through this crisis, but there's another crisis coming with the debt limit in 2 months and then another one after that with the silly sequester where we're going to cut the defense budget by $400 billion. God help us, if we could, we would. But in any case, they haven't yet grasped that the Republican Party, and especially the financial moguls led by Karl Rove, who have financed the Republican Party into taking these positions, are now astride an impossible contradiction. And it goes like this. The Republicans say, we're going to stick to our guns. We don't care that we lost the election. We don't care that the people dislike us. We are going to block everything until the Democrats and Obama cave in and they whack all these silly social programs and they cut Social Security, blah, blah, blah. And I suggest the question to ask is, where do these guys come from and who hires them to be our elected representatives? Because the answer, everyone knows, is the corporate financial wealth holders and powerful institutions that have been pushing this song and insist that it's necessary. Only now they're little tigers on the right. The Republican House members are proposing to put our economy, our valuable position in the world economy and the faith in the dollar and the U.S. good behavior at risk. And they say they're willing to pull it down. You see what I'm driving at?
Sure.
The politics we need to start right now, and I'm going to write this, I'm sure, again and again in the pages of The Nation, is forget John Boehner for the moment. Forget all these silly right-wing crazies in the House of Representatives. The question needs to be put to Jamie Dimon, CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase, and to Karl Rove, and to the Bank of America, and to the Wall Street investment houses like Goldman Sachs. These people all made a point of financing the Republican Party in this last election. Is this what they paid for? Is this what they want? Because they can't have it both ways. They can't say, government has to be respectful of the financial markets and our financial institutions, because if we get in trouble, the whole country is just gone. It's just gone. And then at the same time, put these goons in the role of controlling congressional decisions, and the goons say, we want to tear down the temple. We're perfectly comfortable with collapsing
right.
U.S. credit rating in the world. So this is, to me, a very promising politics if people in the center and the left, whoever, just ordinary people of common sense, will grasp the opportunity and drive it home to those bankers and the rich guys, including Mr. Pete Peterson, and say, is this what you guys are after? Because you're going to wreck the country now, again, if we let you get away with this.
So, William Grider, what's your sense then of the you in your article at the Nation, The Big Lie Loses, you mentioned that the President Obama has been surrounded by bean cutters from the Clinton era, and they call themselves New Democrats. But essentially what they did was they, because the unions weren't coming up with the kind of competitive money needed, Clinton pivoted to Wall Street, and the Democrats became Wall Street light, and the Republicans, the wholly owned subsidiary of corporate America, and corporate America was able to rent out the Democrats. And you're saying, no, wait a minute, maybe we need some new Democrats now. And would
new
that
new
what
we need new
Democrats now? How about a right. new Secretary of the Treasury? I mean,
yeah. Well, that's and here I have to say, if you listen to the Washington gossip, and it's not always wrong, the signs are not, the portents are not promising. I mean, the gossip is that Jack Lew, who was a perfectly decent man, I'm sure, but he's been a respectable agent of the conventional wisdom for 30 years or longer, and he's a budget guy, and he came and he said, see, I don't want to badmouth him. I'm sure he's a serious and competent and conscientious person. But if you make him Secretary of Treasury, you're basically saying, let's continue the form of governing that Robert Rubin launched in 20 years ago with the Clinton administration, which is basically the financial view of what matters in the economy. And as long as you do well by the investment banks and the largest commercial banks, then America will be fine. And not to mention the multinational corporations, which are free to move their production wherever they think they can make it most profitably. My sense is that, not to fight on individuals, but if Obama doesn't have an understanding at this point that he needs to shift to a more aggressive and imaginative agenda of rebuilding the economy with, of course, first the objective of creating the jobs we desperately need to get back our balance, but beyond that, to rebuild the country. And I mean that in everything from, you know, green energy and enterprises to rebalancing the tax system, to restoring obligations of corporate managements to the country rather than to the globe. They're the American companies, and if they want to be American companies, they need to do the following. You know, that sort of politics, and people will say, oh, this is another one of those crazy protectionist left-wingers. All I'm describing is what all of the other major industrial countries in the world do every day. And I mean from Japan to Germany to all the others. So America's lived in this tent for the last 30 years or so, believing in its, or being told of its own superiority, even though working people knew that wasn't true for them. And now we're hit the wall it ought to be time to tell some truth to the people about our position in the world. And I have to say, Obama has a mixed record on that, but he's been pretty good on a lot of stuff. I mean, he's tried to explain to people that these trade deficits are draining our energy, and we need to shift our trade policy and so forth. He hasn't pushed it as aggressively as he ought to, nor has he pushed a stare down with the banking system and a lot of other things. But I'm not willing to sort of badmouth him and give up on him.
No, maybe he just needs some wind at his back.
Yeah, and he's gotten this far with enormous odds against him. I mean, peel back 2 years ago.
Right. Well, I'm afraid we're pretty much out of time here. I'm glad you joined us. I'm glad the dogs were settled, and let's pick
They're padding around me now like I've betrayed.
Right. Well, let's pick up the conversation later, and I thank you for joining us.
Try me again.
Great.
Thank you.
William, I was just speaking then with William Grider, the National Affairs Correspondent for The Nation and author of the bestsellers One World Ready or Not, Secrets of the Temple and Who Will Tell the People. His latest book is The Soul of Capitalism, Opening Paths to a Moral Economy, and his latest article at The Nation is The Big Lie Loses. We're going to take a brief station break, and bestselling author Jared Diamond will join us.
Every crack, anybody wanna tell it like it is to each other, like you would to a sister or a brother. Cut this cosmopolitan style.
A dollar and a half just to see 'em. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They paid paradise, put up a parking lot. Hey, farmer, put away the DDT now. Give me spots on my apples, or leave me the birds and the bees.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Jared Diamond, a professor of geography at UCLA and the recipient of many awards, including the National Medal of Science, the Tyler Prize for Environmental Achievement, Japan's Cosmos Prize, a MacArthur Foundation Fellowship, and the Lewis Thomas Prize honoring the scientist as poet. His books include Why Is Sex Fun?, The Third Chimpanzee, Collapse, and Guns, Germs, and Steel, which won the Pulitzer Prize. And his latest book is The World Until Yesterday, What Can We Learn from Traditional Societies? Welcome to Background Briefing, Jared Diamond.
Thank you, and it's nice to be back with you.
And your latest book, The World Until Yesterday, is in many ways it's a compendium of a lot of your experiences over the decades in New Guinea. And because I was born in Australia and spent some time in New Guinea, so I'm somewhat familiar with the notion that we can learn so much from these societies. One of the things that's most compelling in the book is a photograph that you have of a New Guinea Highlander weeping in terror at his first sight of a European. This happened in 1933, and you have an actual picture of the European confronting these New Guinea Highlanders. And I must say, when I look at this picture of this man in tears, you get the feeling that he really did know something, didn't he?
Well, he was certainly terrified. He identified Europeans as possibly returning ancestral spirits. But I must say, in my own experience in New Guinea, well, I've never had an adult burst into tears at the sight of me. In remote villages in New Guinea, there have been cases where a child, who had evidently never seen a European before, the child turned around and looks at me, and within a few seconds, a look of horror appears on the face of the child, and the child bursts into tears.
So is it inexorable, then, that civilization destroys a planet? I mean, that's what I get from your book is the idea that the march of civilization, what it's done to us as human beings, our hunter-gatherer bodies, and what it's doing to our biosphere, it just seems inexorable that we're on a march towards some kind of collective extinction.
It's easy to get overwhelmed and pessimistic, as you formulated, but in fact there are signs of both hope as well as pessimism. There are societies that have managed their resources well. There are traditional societies, the subject of my current book, that have remained intact in contact with the outside world, even though they've changed selectively. A prime example is Japan, which when opened up forcibly by the outside world, by America and then Europeans in the 19th century, made some significant changes, but Japan is still Japanese. And even within the territory of the United States, Navajo Indians, who are now the most numerous Native American group in North America, the Navajo, half of them still speak Navajo, and they've retained a lot of their traditional culture. So it's not the case that everything is bad and that everybody crumbles.
Well, based on your book Collapse, Jared Diamond, of course, just 2 weeks ago, the world was supposed to end according to the Mayan calendar. So at least we're still speaking to each other, although, of course, the Mayans did collapse. So there is, you know, clearly there is a history of extinction, and there have been mass extinctions. And one of the challenges to the biosphere now, of course, is how we deal with global warming. But when you look at population growth, and some biologists tell us that the ideal population of the planet is about 1 billion in terms of the biosphere, it's only relatively recently that population has exponentially expanded, and that the world that you talk about in your new book, The World Until Yesterday, What We Can Learn from Traditional Societies, they have been living for thousands of years prior to this population explosion. So I understand that that resource depletion and energy use and population growth are the main factors determining the livability of our planet. How do we get back to the natural world? You're suggesting that perhaps that we can adapt to how much we've already changed the world.
It's a mixture of things. We can adapt and stop making further damage. We can adapt and repair some of the damage that we've already caused. We can't bring back species that have gone extinct, but we can bring back populations of species that have not yet gone extinct. And then there's a lot that we can learn from the traditional world to improve our own lives. From my 50 years of experience in New Guinea, I'm impressed by how New Guineans deal with danger and how they raise their children and how they treat their older people, and I've incorporated a lot of that into my daily life, my attitude about dangers, for example, about the dangers of taking showers on slippery marble floors. I've learned a lot from New Guineans, and the way that I brought up my sons, who are now in their 20s, was influenced by how my New Guinea friends bring up their own children.
Well, I have an American daughter, but I did grow up in Australia in the bush, and you do grow up with a little bit of a sense of nature and how dangerous nature can be with snakes and spiders and things that'll kill you and sharks, whatever. Nothing on the level of how forbidding the environment and terrain is in New Guinea, where it's even more hostile. And to some extent, I see my daughter living in the computer age, staring at her palm while three or four of us, her friends, sit at a table staring at their palms. You do get the... You've brought out in your new book, Jared Diamond, The World Until Yesterday, What We Can Learn from Traditional Societies, you brought out the concept of constructive paranoia. So it seems to me that that's a real insight, and elaborate on it, if you will.
That's an insight that I gained from New Guineans. The eye-opening moment for me was when I asked some New Guineans to make a campsite for me under a huge tree. It was gorgeous, and the New Guinean said, "No, this tree is dead." And I looked up and I said, "Yeah, it's dead, but it's not going to tough and robust. It's not going to fall down for 40 years." But the New Guineans refused, and I eventually realized if you're going to spend your life in the jungle, and if you camp out, if you have the habit of camping out under trees, dead trees, for which the chance is 1 in 1,000 they'll fall down that particular night, you probably not die that night, but if you're going to spend more than 1,000 nights in the jungle, eventually you will die. Applications to my own life where I'm ultra careful, some of my friends would say careful to the point of paranoia, about recurrent risks that are low each time. Prime example is taking a shower. So I take a shower every day, and I took a shower 5 hours ago, and it was, I'm sure, the most dangerous thing that I'll do today. Reason is that my shower, like most showers, is marble. It's hard. People slip in the shower. All you have to do is read the obituary columns in any newspaper any day, and you'll see that a significant number of older people die as a result of falls or get crippled from falls from slipping. So I'm very careful about showers. I'm very careful about driving. I've learned from New Guineans to be constructively paranoid, that's to say, to be ultra careful about things that each time they've got a low risk, but you're going to repeat them thousands of times.
Again, I'm speaking with Jared Diamond, professor of geography at UCLA and the author of the bestsellers Collapse and Guns, Germs and Steel, which won the Pulitzer Prize. His latest book is The World Until Yesterday, What We Can Learn from Traditional Societies. So compared to constructive paranoia, we have a kind of artificial paranoia. I mean, if you watch the evening news or local news in particular, you'd think the world has gone mad. Do we pay a collective price for how much we are overstimulated by the threat of terrorism, and even the weather forecasts are apocalyptic nowadays, even though, of course, to some extent, global warming is creating apocalyptic weather. So what price do we pay? Again, the point in many ways of your book is that we have hunter-gatherer bodies that are living in this environment where they're not being used, in effect, in the way that they're intended.
Yeah, the price that we pay for our obsession with terrorists is that we use up our concern about danger on the wrong things. There's only so much of your day that you can spend worrying about dangers. You'd better devote those hours worrying about danger to the right dangers. And if we obsess about terrorists and we obsess about nuclear radiation and we obsess about DNA and chemicals in our crops, we're focusing on the wrong things, the things that we should really be concerned about that will kill far more of us than will terrorists, are driving in cars, alcohol, slipping in showers, and falling off stepladders, and depending on your lifestyle, various other things. So part of it is a matter of figuring out the right danger. The other thing you mentioned about our hunter-gatherer bodies is that our bodies have not changed that much since we stopped being hunter-gatherers, which variously is from a few decades to a few thousand years ago. And our bodies are adapted metabolically to having lots of food sometimes and no food other times. That's all very well until you are living in Los Angeles on a supermarket diet, eating three big meals a day. And if you continue to eat the way a hunter-gatherer does and to store food as fat, you are likely to end up with diabetes, heart disease, stroke, and cancer, conditions that no New Guinean ever dies of.
But in your book, Jared Diamond, your new book, The World Until Yesterday, you cite the example of the island of Nauru, which is independent now. It was a former German, then Australian colony, where rich in phosphates, and that the people did experience. They were hunter-gatherers. Food supply was never guaranteed, and periodic famine. But the minute they started to get royalties from phosphates, then they went to the supermarket, they got fat, and I think, was it up to 70% of the population has diabetes?
By age 70, yes, those few narrow ones who are lucky enough to survive till age 70, something like 70% of them get diabetes. Nauru is one of the three populations in the world with the highest frequency of diabetes. But this isn't we used to think, oh, those narrow ones are so exceptional. We now know that all populations around the world, other than Europeans, to whom this happened centuries ago, all other populations of the world, when they start adopting the supermarket Western lifestyle, end up with high frequencies of diabetes. This is attested within North America, especially for Native Americans and for African Americans, as well as Europeans. It's attested for Aboriginal Australians, Pacific Islanders, and nowadays, within the past decade, the two countries that have the largest number of diabetics in the world, although a few decades ago they had vanishingly few diabetics, are India and China, because with rising affluence, wealthier people in India and China are eating a lot and they're getting diabetes.
Well, I spoke recently with a researcher up at UCSF who's doing research into childhood obesity, and there seems to be an undeniable connection between particularly high fructose corn syrup, which is in almost every food that you buy, every item that you buy in the supermarket has it in it. And so you don't make the case, but can one make the case that corporate food is killing us?
One can make the case that some corporate food is contributing to killing many of us. It means that we have to be attentive in what we eat and read the labels in the supermarket. But on top of that, it's not enough for us as individuals to be attentive. For example, my wife and I, we don't have salt on the dining table. And I used to think that I'm virtuous, I don't take in much salt, therefore I'll have low blood pressure. The sad part of it is that a lot of the salt and a lot of the sugar in our diet is hidden. It's cryptic. It's been added by the food manufacturers so that when you buy any food or when you eat in a restaurant, even if you don't sprinkle salt on your food, you're taking in a lot of salt. Adding salt to food is something that food manufacturers do because it's a cheap way of binding water, and therefore, instead of you're paying for 1 pound of chicken, you're paying for 1.25 pounds of chicken, even though only 1/4 of it is chicken, and even though only 1 pound of it is chicken, and 1/4 of it is salt water that's been injected. All of this is a way of saying that not only do we have to be attentive to our personal choices, but we've got to get our government to work together with food manufacturers to impose healthy standards on food for the public.
And Jared Diamond, another aspect of a modern life in the sense that what we're losing in terms of the what we call primitive societies or traditional societies, the notion of the tactile nature of child rearing, which is in traditional societies like in New Guinea, for example, women carry the babies with them everywhere. And I'm fascinated to see how you've pointed out here how much we lose in terms of nurturing children by having kids in a pram that we push where they're facing in the wrong direction. And so just elaborate on that point, because I find it fascinating.
I, too, am fascinated by it. Part of my fascination comes just over the past 50 years with dealing with young New Guineans, kids who are 5 years old or 7 years old, and they're self-confident. They'll talk with me as an adult, and there's no shyness about it. They make their own decisions. In one case, about 45 years ago, I was hiring carriers in a village, and I needed lots of carriers. There was one kid, he was probably about 10 years old, who volunteered to be a carrier for me. So his parents weren't around, but he didn't ask his parents' permission. It was taken for granted. He's a 10-year-old kid. Of course, he can decide what he wants. And so he marched off with me to carry for a week. And then at the end of a week, I wanted to hire some people to work on birds with me. So he stayed another 3 weeks. His parents didn't know where he was, but he's a 10-year-old kid, and he's capable of making his own decisions. We don't allow that. We micromanage our kids. We don't allow that freedom. We don't hold our kids. We put our kids down in a crib so that they're not in contact with an adult as infants, whereas a New Guinean or a traditional child is in contact with an adult like 95% of the time.
So just in closing, Jared Diamond, it seems that given what you're telling us in this new book, The World Until Yesterday, What We Can Learn from Traditional Societies, that we can't go back. Perhaps we should change our society radically in ways that in which we'll be healthier and more in touch with our environment. But it does seem that we've just gone through Christmas, and you've got this very, very telling picture of how in traditional societies, children are given toys which are manufactured out of what they can find, and they still find them inspiring and entertaining. And then you've got it contrasting that with a young American girl surrounded by a surplus of toys, which now, you know, a week after Christmas, I'm sure a lot of stuff has already been shoved in the closet. So we have this culture that tells us that we need things and that we're insufficient as human beings without things. And that seems to be the big challenge, isn't it? as we're all downsized out of economic necessity. And another point you make, too, is that as a society, we should learn from other societies that revere their elders. And as you know, this whole fiscal cliff argument's been over cutting Social Security benefits for the old. So we are going in the opposite direction in terms of reverence for the elderly. And I don't see any evidence that we're starting to come up with different ways for our children to find self-esteem through other things other than material possessions.
Well, you put your finger on a dilemma. As you said at the beginning, there's no going back. And yes, there's no going back massively. We're not going to have radical change in our society. If you suggest any radical change, people will close their ears. But we can make selective change, and there is going back in certain respects. For example, spanking or not spanking your children. When I was growing up, it was usual for parents to spank their children. But there are lots of parents today who don't spank their children, and in small traditional societies, parents don't spank their children. That contributes to the children being self-confident and independent and making their own decisions. As for revering elders, a real challenge for the United States and for all Western societies is to find a use for older people. We are getting technologically outdated. I can't turn on the wretched computer that my wife and my sons have, but I can operate a slide rule. But who on earth wants to use a slide rule nowadays? So on the one hand, much of my knowledge is out of date, and I lack modern knowledge that's important. But on the other hand, I've experienced things that happened 40 or 60 years ago that young people 15 or 20 years ago haven't experienced. And so, for example, when I talk to hedge fund managers, the people managing hedge funds typically are in their 20s and 30s. They haven't been through a Great Depression. They haven't seen the big swings of 20 years ago, and that's part of the reason why the average hedge fund lasts 5 years, because the young whiz kids just don't have the experience of older people.
But just to the point of how do we, as a society, if we are to, in effect, be downsized as more people on the planet, as the haves and the have-nots meet somewhere, I think inevitably we're going to be downsized. The planet cannot sustain everybody having the standard of living of the average American and consuming as much as the average American. So it would seem to me that inevitably we'll have to find another way to find work for people and to judge people based upon other things than the number of their possessions.
You're correct that we have to lower our consumption rate. That's the biggest part of it. Another part of it is reducing or at least not increasing further our population, but lowering our consumption rate is a big piece of it. I get hope there because I came back recently from Europe, and Europeans per person consume not much more than half of the average American, and yet the standard of living in Europe by any reasonable criterion, such as educational opportunities, security in old age, standard of living in Europe is, if anything, higher than in the United States, despite their consuming less. So I take hope from that. There are people out there who enjoy a first-world living standard, but they don't consume.
Well, Jared Diamond, obviously we could talk on forever here, and I'm very grateful for the time you've been able to spend with us.
You are welcome. Thank you for your interesting questions.
Again, I've been speaking with Jared Diamond, who's a professor of geography at UCLA and the recipient of many awards, including the National Medal of Science, the Tyler Prize for Environmental Achievement, Japan's Cosmos Prize, a MacArthur Foundation Fellowship, and the Lewis Thomas Prize honoring the scientist as poet. His books include Why Is Sex Fun?, The Third Chimpanzee, Collapse, and Guns, Germs, and Steel, which won the Pulitzer Prize. His latest book is The World Until Yesterday, What Can We Learn from Traditional Societies?
And this has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can contact me. And the conversation continues at facebook.com/ianmastersmedia. And I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.